Hello, this is Rita Schulte with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated today, June 22nd, 2018. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Local Law Enforcement Honored, Women of the Moose Lodge Offer Thanks, Praise, and Goodies, by Jacqueline Cook, Dateline Decatur. Connie Flemings and fellow members of Decatur's Women of the Moose Chapter 36 are aware of the many sacrifices law enforcement officers make while protecting the community. To show the area's law enforcement that their work will never go unrecognized, Flemings' organization honored the Decatur Police Department and the Macon County Sheriff's Office during a ceremony on Thursday. We want them to know that we're behind them. We care for them. And we want them to be safe here in Decatur, said Flemings, junior regent for the local Women of the Moose chapter. The nationwide organization is a sister auxiliary to the International Loyal Order of the Moose. We're hoping that people will realize how important they are, she said. Dozens of people filled the Fraternal Order of Eagles Lodge at 602 West King Street to watch as the group of the area's finest were presented with special plaques and goodie bags filled with candy that bore special meanings, such as lifesavers, to remind you of the many times you've been one. Thursday's event was the first time the group had organized anything like this. The chapter has roots in service, donating time and resources to organizations like the Social Services Group, Dove Inc., and Homeless Ministry, God's Shelter of Love. Following the lead of some of its sister chapters around the country, the local group thought there was no better time than the present to pay respect to the local law enforcement community. They put their lives on the line, said Senior Regent Gloria Brown. We just want to show them our appreciation for them. Decatur Police Chief James Kortgetz and Macon County Sheriff Howard Buffett accepted the plaques on behalf of their departments. Both were imprinted with a colorful design that read, Real heroes don't wear capes. Brown said the Women of the Moose put together 207 of the candy bags for members of both departments. She said 55 were made for the sheriff's office and 152 were made for the police, along with a few special treats for canine officers. After the ceremony, all of the present law enforcement officials were given opportunity to mingle with everyone who came to the event. Most of the conversations with the uniformed men and women began or ended with an expression of gratitude for their service. Police Lieutenant Brad Allen and Deputy Chief Jason Walker both said it was a nice change of pace to be honored during such a casual and intimate display. It might not be realistic for law enforcement to have the support of the entire community at all times, Allen said. But events like the Women of the Moose Appreciation Ceremony can make a big difference to their morale and in the community's overall perception. Some of the people in this room may not have time to spend with us, or they might not have ever been around an officer, Allen said. So they might go out and tell everybody they know how we are and how much fun they had. It's a way to kind of build support, too. Sheriff's Lieutenant John Butt said the ceremony was a sign of how compassionate the local community is. Working in the line of duty can be tough at times, he said, but that wasn't the case Thursday night. It's a blessing, Butt said of the ceremony. Attempt to oust SIU president fails. Board splits vote to place Dunn on leave, by K. Janice Esch, Edwardsville. The Southern Illinois Board of Trustees was split Thursday on whether to oust President Randy Dunn, deadlocking in a 4-4 vote after nearly 4 hours of deliberating in executive session. At a special meeting on the Edwardsville campus, a motion to place Dunn on administrative leave failed after the Edwardsville community rallied in his defense during a public comment period. Had the motion passed, Dunn would have been placed on administrative leave for 120 days while outside legal counsel investigated the president's office, including allegations that Dunn knew about legislation being floated to make SIU's Carbondale and Edwardsville campuses separate university systems. Dunn, who early in his career was an administrator in the Argenta Orellana schools, has faced widespread criticism over his handling of a proposal to shift $5.1 million in state appropriations funding from Carbondale to Edwardsville, and over an internal email in which he referred to critics of the reallocation on the Carbondale campus as bitchers. The board also voted Thursday to release documents that supposedly shed more light on Dunn's alleged collusion with Edwardsville officials and have not yet been seen by the public. It is unclear when and how the documents will be released. Trustees J. Phil Gilbert and Joel W. Samburski, both of Carbondale, read long-prepared statements portraying Dunn as disloyal and favoring the Edwardsville campus over Carbondale instead of working for the overall good of SIU. "He can no longer effectively function as head of the system," Gilbert said in his remarks, making the motion for administrative leave. Samburski said Dunn gave the board deliberately misleading information. Based on 1,000 pages of emails and other documents reviewed by trustees, President Dunn's job is to advance the SIU system, advocate for the SIU system, not maneuver behind the scenes to stall, divide, and constantly try to work to dissolve it, Samburski said. Trustee Amy Schaller said after the meeting that neither she nor Dunn would comment. The move to oust Dunn came amid controversy over the failed move to shift funding. Carbondale is the flagship campus of the system, but Edwardsville, barely 60 years old, has seen a steady rise in enrollment over the past two decades, while Carbondale has struggled to increase its numbers. 15 people spoke during the public comments Thursday. 14 were SIUE faculty and staff members who defended Dunn. Shelley Price Williams, a professional staff member at SIUE School of Business and an adjunct professor, said she values Dunn's visibility in the Edwardsville campus and his advocacy for SIUE when it comes to the funding shift. "I challenge this board to envision not what we once were, but what we are becoming, a premier institution in the Midwest. I challenge this board to augment our innovation and success with appropriate funding structure that distinguishes our environment and needs from that of Carbondale," Price Williams said. Kathleen Schalitz, the SIUC faculty member who discovered the internal emails that led to the controversy, said Dunn has been purposefully undermining the Carbondale campus. "At this time, it is difficult, if not impossible, for the Carbondale campus community to trust Dr. Dunn and his leadership," Schalitz says. Ann Hunter, incoming president of the SIUE Staff Senate, said she has frequently seen SIUE painted as less important than Carbondale. She said Dunn simply stated the obvious by pointing out that SIUC receives a disproportionate share of appropriations. Ignoring it and hoping that Edwardsville won't put up too much of loud of a fuss isn't going to work any longer, Hunter said. Ian Toberman, University Honors Program Advisor at SIUE, slammed the board for its treatment of Edwardsville. "This board will continue to struggle with its legitimacy until such time that you prove to us, this community, that you are not aligned against us. We're watching and we're waiting," Toberman said. Laura Scarturo, Office Manager at SIUE's Lovejoy Library, praised Dunn for his transparency. "This is the first SIU president that has ever popped into the administrative offices here in Lovejoy Library in my 24 years. That in itself speaks volumes as far as I'm concerned," Scaturo said. SIUE faculty member Steve Kerber said removing Dunn would cause immeasurable harm to SIUC. "Please be aware that SIUE does not exist to subsidize programs at Carbondale. Inferior status is not acceptable, and the time has arrived for the flagship mentality to end," Kerber said. Dunn previously was president of Youngstown State University in Ohio and Murray State University in Kentucky. He also was superintendent of Argenta Orellana Schools in 1989. He was the youngest superintendent in Macon County, hired at age 31, and joked in an interview with the Herald and Review that he'd been teased about being a young principal, too. He became principal at the age of 24. Leadership in education isn't grounded in age alone, Dunn said in an interview with the Herald and Review. We're a people enterprise, and organization, personality, and leadership style are important too. He was chosen from a field of 53 candidates for the position and had served as principal of Roanoke Benson Junior High School and at Paw Paw Elementary School prior to that. He began his education career as a third and fourth grade teacher in Gibson City. He is a 1980 graduate of Illinois State University. In 1989, he had completed coursework for a doctorate in education at the University of Illinois, but had not yet presented his thesis. Finances were a challenge in Argenta Orianna then, and he said that would have taken attention, but his main goal was to protect the district's strong academic programs from budget challenges. He later taught at the Joint Doctoral Program in Educational Leadership at SIUE. He became the president of SIU in 2014. Several lawmakers have called for Dunn's resignation after the release of an email in which he characterized supporters of the Carbondale campus as bitchers. Dunn has apologized for the April 4th email, sent prior to a Board of Trustees vote to reallocate state funding from Carbondale campus to Edwardsville. SIU Carbondale receives more than $91 million in state funding annually, while the Edwardsville campus receives $51.5 million. And here's a story about the local Decatur economy. Moving in the right direction. Decatur area adds 500 non-farm jobs in May, by Ryan Voiles. Dateline Decatur. The Decatur metro area added 500 jobs in May, marking the fifth straight month of recorded job growth in the area. The Decatur area, which includes all of Macon County, had a total of 51,800 non-farm jobs in May, up from 51,300 the previous year, according to preliminary data released Thursday afternoon by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Illinois Department of Employment Security. Decatur's unemployment rate in May was 4.5%, down from 4.7% in May 2017. We always say everything starts with jobs, and that foundational number is moving in the right direction, said Ryan McCready, president of the Economic Development Corporation of Decatur and Macon County. While retail is shrinking everywhere, growth in manufacturing and healthcare fields shows that people in the area can become re-employed, he said. It's a good time for jobs, but we need to build our workforce, and that's what we're focusing on right now, said Rocky Wilkerson, Executive Director of Workforce Investment Solutions, a county agency that administers federal and state job training programs. Right now, my focus is to build the workforce that becomes even more intense when you know the employers need to hire. While Decatur's unemployment rate was down, it remains the second highest in all of Illinois' 14 metro areas, topped only by Danville at 5.1%. Communities across the state saw unemployment rate decreases, and Illinois' overall unemployment rate was 3.5%, dropping from 4.4% a year ago. I think the one thing to take away is the downstate numbers over the past year have been getting better over, say, last year, said Bob Goh, Public Information Office for the Illinois Department of Employment Security. Last year, most of the positive news was generated out of Chicago. Now, Chicago is pretty solid, but now downstate is seeing some pickup as well. The numbers suggest that the improved unemployment picture reflects a genuine strengthening of the labor market, and not merely a result of the people who stopped looking for work or left the area for employment elsewhere, said Tom Austin, also from IDES. We have seen declines in the number of unemployed, so some may have left the labor force or moved elsewhere. But when we look at the employment data, we see more people are employed, Austin said. The unemployed are those out of work but looking for employment. The number is not tied to unemployment benefits. Quick actions save dog. Fire department responds to two Decatur house fires, by Claire Hettinger and Jalen Cook. Decatur. Quick actions of neighbors and firefighters saved an 8-year-old dog from a fire that heavily damaged a home on West Wagoner Street, the second of two unrelated house fires handled by the Decatur Fire Department on Thursday. I didn't think she would make it. She was really hot and was having trouble breathing, said James Hawkins, who lives across the street. Touching her was like touching hot coal. Hawkins and another passerby pulled the dog, Tiara, from the burning home, and 15-year-old Jaheim Smith Rice and his family carried her to their yard to cool down. Firefighters gave her oxygen from a special mask for pets that had been donated to the department, and she was well enough to greet her owner when he arrived on the scene. "It was like nothing I'd ever seen a person do," said neighbor Mary Penix of watching the rescue unfold. "No one was at home during the fire, reported at 2:40 p.m. at 921 West Wagoner Street," investigators said it stemmed from electrical causes. An estimated $15,000 of damage made the structure a total loss. Earlier in the day, one man was hospitalized after a fire broke out in the kitchen at his home, 1650 North Union Street. Firefighters went to the scene at 7:20 a.m. and put out the flames within 23 minutes, the department said. The injured man was able to escape and was taken to HSHS St. Mary's Hospital for treatment. The fire department estimated the fire caused $10,000 in damage to the house, which is valued at $25,000. Its cause was ruled accidental and cooking related. The American Red Cross assisted the occupants displaced by both fires. In the West Wagoner Street fire, Hawkins, the neighbor across the street, said he heard an explosion and ran to the house after he saw flames coming from the windows. He was afraid that his neighbor, John Archibald, might be inside, so he ran across the street and tried to ram the door down with the help of another passerby. The two also broke the front window, and that's when they heard a small noise, Tiara's bark. They finally got the door open and were able to bring her to the front yard. The commotion caught the attention of Jaheim Smith Rice and his mother, Kaisha Smith, who picked up Tiara and carried her into their yard away from the smoke. Along with Smith's daughter, Dombria Smith Rice, they worked to cool her off with water and comfort her. They were soon relieved by Lieutenant Dylan Pritz and firefighters Mike Smith and John Snowden, who gave Tiara oxygen and more water until she began to come around. She was able to greet Archibald when he arrived at the scene. She only left his side to sniff around a tarp laid out over the body of her son, 6-year-old Digger. Firefighters found the other dog already dead inside the house. Archibald said he was very grateful for his neighbor's actions. In an interview at the scene, he said he was at a loss for what to do next. He said he was thankful for his neighbor's actions, but at a loss for what to do next. "Right now, I'm just kind of in shock," he said. "I don't know what the hell I'm going to do." In another story about the Clinton power plant, regulators investigate the Clinton station without backup power during refueling process. The story by Kevin Barlow. Clinton. Inspectors with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission are investigating an incident that left the Clinton nuclear power plant without an emergency diesel generator in service during a refueling outage last month. NRC officials said Thursday that a 3-member team will review the sequence of events and the plant's analysis, determine the probable causes, evaluate shutdown procedures, and assess the corrective actions taken. The team will spend time both on and off site. After the inspection, a report documenting the team's findings will be issued and made public. According to NRC regulations, at least one emergency diesel generator must be operable during a refueling outage. Emergency diesel generators are safety-related systems designed to provide power to the site if there's a loss of off-site power, the agency said. NRC officials reported that during the May outage, plant workers removed each emergency diesel generator from service one at a time to perform maintenance. However, as they were working on the second unit, a plant worker discovered that the first generator was not completely restored to operating status. Once the issue was identified, workers took immediate action to restore a diesel generator to operable service as required by regulations, said the agency. The plant has been receiving increased NRC oversight since last year due to a finding of low to moderate safety significance involving an issue with an emergency diesel generator room ventilation fan. From the police blotter, "Man denies being part of gunfight" by Tony Reed, Decatur. A Decatur man who prosecutors said was shot in a street gunfight has pleaded not guilty to a charge of unlawfully possessing a weapon as a felon. A sworn police affidavit linked to the case said Charles L. Palmer, 27, arrived at Decatur Memorial Hospital with a bullet hole in his arm on the morning of August 30th after gunfire erupted in the area of East Hickory and North Woodford Street. Palmer was arrested June 3rd. During the hearing Wednesday, Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott said Palmer matched witnesses' description of one of the gunmen. The affidavit quotes the suspect who resembled Palmer as getting hit during the gunfight. The subject fell and stated, "I'm hit." He was then driven away from the scene, the statement said. Scott said a .22 caliber handgun found dumped in a front yard on the 1400 block of East Hickory was later matched by the state police crime lab with Palmer's DNA. The match was so close it was classified as one in 460 billion. Judge Jeffrey Geisler ruled there was sufficient evidence to proceed with the case against Palmer and scheduled it for a pretrial hearing July 31st. Palmer remained held in the Macon County Jail on Thursday night in lieu of posting $50,000 bond. In another story, dog shootings are being investigated. Decatur. Detectives are investigating after a pit bull was brought to a Decatur veterinary clinic Wednesday with multiple gunshot wounds. The dog has since been euthanized by the Macon County Animal Control and Care Center, said Detective Sergeant Steve Carroll of the Decatur Police Department. Carroll said the dog had first been brought to the Decatur Animal Clinic, 1445 East Pershing Road, by two women who had rescued it. Carroll said they had persuaded the two men they said had shot the dog to let them take it. Police are seeking the men on preliminary charges of animal cruelty. In another story, shooting victim is recovering. Decatur. The male victim of an early morning Sunday shooting in Decatur continues to recover as police search for the suspect they said pulled the trigger. The 34-year-old victim had suffered wounds initially described as life-threatening around 3:15 a.m. in the 1000 block of East Main Street. Decatur Police Detective Sergeant Steve Carroll said Thursday that the victim, who had been taken to HSHS St. Mary's Hospital and then transferred to HSHS St. John's Hospital in Springfield, was now doing okay. Police continued their search for Corey J. Marquis, 30, who's been sought on a preliminary charge of attempted murder. In local sports, Glidewell is named the new LSA coach in a story by Decatur Herald and Review. Former MacArthur and St. Teresa volleyball coach Rhonda Glidewell has been hired to take over the LSA volleyball program, according to LSA athletic director Kurt Younghouse. Glidewell, who began her coaching career at LSA, will be in charge of the program from 4th to 12th grade. "We're happy to welcome Coach Glidewell back to LSA," Younghouse said in a statement. "Our goal is always to have dedicated and relational coaches to help develop and lead our teams. Coach Glidewell is a great addition, and we look forward to seeing how she will impact our student athletes and the volleyball program." Glidewell went 46-57-2 in her three seasons with St. Teresa. She also coached MacArthur for a season and had a highly successful run at Our Lady of Lourdes, winning two state titles, two second-place finishes, one third-place finish, five sectional titles, and seven regional titles. In another story, the IDOC director states recidivism rate needs to be addressed. "More needs to be done to improve re-entry into life without bars," by Edith Brady Lunny, Bloomington, Illinois. "The challenging work of cutting the state's recidivism rate requires energy and resources from inside and outside prison walls," the director of the Illinois Department of Corrections told an audience Thursday in Bloomington. "The current recidivism rate of 43% reflects a downward trend," John Baldwin told about 50 people at a meeting at Mennonite Church of Normal and organized by Jobs Partnership, a program of the Joy Care Center. "But 43% is not acceptable. We have to return people better to the community than when they came to us, said the former Iowa Corrections Director, who left retirement in 2015 to lead Illinois' troubled prison system. Volunteers, like those who work with Jobs Partnership to help ex-offenders with housing, jobs, and other necessities, serve a critical role in helping former prisoners stay out of prison, said Baldwin. Recidivism, measured as a return within 3 years of release, is detrimental on several levels, he said. Recidivism creates more victims and a waste of taxpayers' money. We need to give people a chance not to come back to us, said Baldwin. Baldwin pointed to a reduction in the prison population to a number below 40,000 for the first time in many years as one of the many payoffs for IDOC efforts. Some serious challenges remain, however, and the solutions will take years to be fully realized. Baldwin acknowledged, the state is dealing with a preliminary injunction in a federal lawsuit over deficiencies in its mental health treatment to 12,000 inmates, and other federal lawsuit on medical care is set to go to trial in the fall. The mental health care issues can be traced to poor decisions more than a decade ago when treatment was severely curtailed, according to Baldwin. We have to fundamentally improve the level of psychiatric and medical treatment to all people. It's imperative, said Baldwin, noting that almost a third of inmates are mentally ill. Baldwin heard from audience members who faced difficulties securing jobs since their release. Changes in state and federal law is needed, said one former offender, to allow more access to jobs. Baldwin agreed. The state's reentry center in Kewaunee is the nation's and Illinois' first attempt to try to help people with major sentences not to come back, said Baldwin. The 600-bed facility that once housed juvenile offenders operates a life skills program for men who are preparing for release after long sentences. Changes in how Illinois prisons operate will be measured under new data collection mandates. For example, Kewaunee participants will be monitored after their release to determine what, if any, changes should be made to the program, Baldwin said. Jobs Partnership leader Michelle Cook said the cooperation between the Bloomington program and IDOC helps offenders build a connection with the community before they leave prison. Since 2011, about 1,400 ex-offenders have been served by the Bloomington program, and we've only lost 19 back to the Department of Corrections, said Cook. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, June 22, 2018. Please stay tuned.